First of all, I want to thank you for your greetings and prayers. All I can tell you is I don't deserve any recognition. Honest. Thanks a million. Give me a few days to get those rosaries for you, but I get one for every single member of the community. Our present meditation is obviously on obedience. Since the whole of the Gospels is a revelation of the practice of obedience by the Son of God, there is no classic passage on the counsel of obedience in the New Testament. The New Testament is the revelation of God becoming man that man might be obedient to man. We begin then, as we have been doing, with quoting this time from the Code of Canon Law on the practice of the Evangelical Council of Obedience. Says the Code, says the Church, the Evangelical Council of Obedience, undertaken in the spirit of faith and love in the following of Christ, who was obedient even unto death, obliges submission of one's will to lawful superiors who act in the place of God when they give commands in accordance with each institute's own constitutions. For the record, Canon 601. My plan here will be to, as we have been doing, explain what the Church means and then keep applying the implications to ourselves. As with chastity and poverty, religious, by definition, bind themselves to go beyond the precept of obedience, which, by definition, the precept is binding on every member of the Church, and in fact, on every human being. What exactly then does the expression counsel of obedience mean? This is no trifling matter, because the very word obedience implies, surely, in our English vocabulary, implies the duty or obligation, and therefore precept. How then is religious obedience a counsel, if by prior definition it already obliges? Here's what the Church means. I have this in five parts. First, as Catholics, whether priests, religious, or the laity, we are obliged to obey the laws of the Church, which by definition are binding on all the faithful. In Christ's closing commission to the apostles, as given us by Matthew at the end of his gospel, Christ told his disciples to go and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe, to obey all that I have commanded you. Christianity is nothing if it is not the religion of obedience. Second, as citizens of this state, every person in our own country is further obliged to obey all the just laws of the country, whether those laws are national, state, local. In other words, just laws. Are we obliged to obey the unjust laws? No, we are forbidden. Kethaverda. That's why I don't see the Colosseum was built. But that's one important function it served for those thousands who rather lay down their lives to obey Caesar when Caesar was commanding what was contrary to God. Third observation. In essence, every duty of obedience pertains to submitting one's will to the will of those in authority in a society. From children who are to obey their parents to, say, every Catholic who is obliged to obey the Vicar of Christ. In other words, you have to have a society on earth in order to have, well, someone in authority who then is to be obeyed. Three words go together: society, authority, and obedience. The Greeks, by the way, had a word for a group of people who do not recognize authority. The Greek word is spelled C-H-A-O-S, chaos. Good to know that. In other words, a society, a rational, civilized society, exists only insofar as there is someone in authority in that society and others who then obey that authority. Number four, except for the incarnation, you would not know of any higher authority better, of any higher obedience to authority than what we've just said, where then obedience is a duty to obey the just laws of legitimate authority in any human society. It is impossible. That's the only word I can use. It is impossible to exaggerate the importance of understanding what God did when he became man and assumed a human will. That's the main reason God became man. To assume a human will, so that then, without human free will, the God-man might obey. However, we're saying more. When God became man, he introduced a form more sublime form of obedience than was ever conceived before God became incarnate. God introduced as a man a more sublime form of obedience than was ever even dreamed possible. Why? Because God was God. And what a safe statement. God was not obliged to obey any human created authority. In teaching the theology of the spiritual life, I never tire repeating, underlying, insisting on the need for God to become man to make what we call the counsel of obedience even a reality. What did Christ do? What did he do? He voluntarily, notice now, with his human will, united with the divine will, quite voluntarily, without being required to do so. No binding duty to obey. Yet, God became man, that is man, he might undertake a life of obedience to religious and civil authority. Talk about freedom. It beggars human description. Thus, for example, when God became man, he was born at Bethlehem because the Roman emperor ordered the census of all the people in the empire, which included reporting to their family town. For Christ it was Bethlehem. When God became man, he was circumcised 8 days after birth in obedience to the then Judaic ecclesiastical authority. He was presented in the temple 40 days after birth. By the way, obedience, in case nobody told you, is mathematical. Did you know that? According to Jewish law, the child was to be presented to the temple 40 days after birth. Not 41 or 42, 40 days after birth. Christ came to the temple as required of each, remember, of each young boy on reaching the age of the then considered Jewish maturity, about the age of 12. For 30 years, Christ was obedient to Mary and Joseph. They were his creatures. He was their God. Never in the wildest imagination of our dreams will they ever obey anyone who is more objectively our inferior than were Mary and Joseph inferior to Christ who obeyed them. Yet, and that yet is by divine choice. He voluntarily, without being obliged to obey them, that statement, without being obliged to, is much deeper, more to be said about it than I can cover, even the 60 minutes that I am subjecting your patience to listening. Voluntariety has no deeper meaning in heaven or on earth than the voluntariety of the man Jesus Christ, who assumed a human will to obey his own creatures. Throughout his public life, Christ was obedient to the Mosaic law. Sometimes just page through Deuteronomy, or for that matter, the book of Numbers. You blink, one regulation after another. One of my Jewish students, in the 5-year tenure at a state university where I taught, came to my office one day, told me he was an Orthodox Jew, but living in a dormitory and going to a state university, he could not observe the kosher laws. And they are very binding, very detailed. Christ obeyed the Mosaic laws. You may be sure that Christ ate kosher food. Throughout his public life, not only did he obey the Mosaic law, but been on occasion to emphasize that he was master of the law. There we see he broke the Sabbath law and told the Jews, my friends, just for the record, I am master of the Sabbath. During his passion, from being taken captive by his enemies to his final expiration on the cross, Christ was literally obedient unto death. Obedient to the authority of the coward Pilate, ordered him to be scourged and finally crucified. Obedient to the authority of the unjust Sanhedrin that consciously had plotted his destruction. All of this we need to hear, why? To make clear what kind of obedience Christ practiced. This is a build-up. Consciously and deliberately, to make sure we understand what we mean when we casually say that we undertake to practice the counsel and beyond or above the precept of obedience. Not binding unless and until under, as we believe, divine inspiration, we bind ourselves. It is Christ's obedience practice today by those who out of love for him, voluntary, like him, undertake to be obedient beyond and above what they, that's you and me, beyond what we would have been obliged to obey as members either of the natural society of the state or the supernatural society of the church. As we said at the beginning, we repeat, the essence of consecrated life is in the word more. We come back to this word more, which we say is built into every evangelical council. Here, the more of consecrated obedience. I've taught too many villages for too many years. I live with too many not to know the basic problem with obedience for us religious is in the mind. Once the mind sees, but it better see. Or better, it had better want to see, which means look. To understand what we had entered into when we became religious. As religious, we freely undertake to submit ourselves to human authority in the church, to obey in a way and in things and in such detail as we should never, I would underline the adverb, never have been obliged to do had we not decided to imitate Jesus Christ, who freely submitted himself to human authority, and I repeat, I think the seventh time, with no obligation on his part to do so. That's the council. It is not, it would never have been, binding under sin unless we, with eyes wide open, and I assume, sober and sane, when we take our vows. So far, something of the meaning of the Council of Obedience. I think it was worth the time. The church, however, continues by telling us we undertake to practice this counsel in imitation of Christ, in the spirit of faith and love, in the following of the Master. These are no idle words. There are two key words which are the underlying motivation for the practice of obedience are faith and love. We must first believe on faith that Christ is God. Everything rests on this foundation. Is God, now it's the eighth time, is God. Christ was not required to obey. That would be blasphemy. Yet, he assumed a human nature with a human will in order to be able to obey. And he, obeying with a freedom that is terrifying, God submitting to a creature. Why Why? First, to merit for us the grace of humility. It was pride which brought sin first into the world, and it is pride that is the underlying cause of all sin, including yours and mine. Why? In order to teach us first that we should obey, and how to obey, and thereby cooperate with Christ in, dare we say it, co-redeeming a sinful, that is, a proud world. Over the 4+ centuries of our existence, the Society of Jesus has tried to choose, and I have to say this, above normally intelligent people. Having worked with our prevention and helping in the screening of candidates, too many B's in college would disqualify a man for becoming a member of the society. Well, having taught over 600 of them, by now, and not a few of my former students have entered eternity. My superior now is my former student. By now I can give you, well, a kind of a synthesis of who over the years, and I watched them. I would not dare identify names. Who among the priests that I've taught have been over the years the most successful in proclaiming and advancing the kingdom of Christ? Not the most brilliant, not the most mentally or socially or psychologically gifted. They've been those who have been most humble in obeying, let me tell you, and obedience, especially in our age, can be very, very hard. Oh, how autobiographical I could get. Needless to say, I will restrain my vocabulary. We must believe. Believe that Jesus is God. And as God became man in order to be able to obey the way he gives some people the grace to obey after his example. However, he must furthermore love. Love God in the person of Christ sufficiently to want to become like him here. Love seeks assimilation. It wants to be transformed into the one that it claims it loves.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the cassette over for side two.